How could such a smart kid turn into such a moron? He'd just blown contact and probably frozen himself to death in the process. When he tried to walk, his legs wouldn't move, muscle spasm due to advancing hypothermia. He did not want to die before he'd kissed a girl, or had a paper published, or even driven a damn car. His pajamas snapped in the wind, his face got more and more caked in frost, and he prayed his usual prayer. "Any god who happens to be real, this is Connor Callahan, and I could use some help. Thank you. Really use it." The world around him seemed to grow quiet. He looked down at his right hand. He could see the snow hitting it and bouncing off, but he could no longer feel anything. But he did feel something really funny, a sort of jittering in his heels. It spread through his feet, and he noticed it in his hands, too. Then it went up his arms and legs, bringing with it wonderful warmth like a really good blanket would if he was cold and Mom came in and tucked him in. Then a face popped out from behind a tree, huge eyes, tiny mouth communicating surprise, fear, concern all at once. Boy, Connor thought, do they ever look like bugs? "Oh, no. I won't run. Relax. As long as you keep me warm, consider us friends." What's he saying? I have no idea. Striding out of the snow on his long, thin legs came the tall gray. As he came closer, Connor could see that his body shimmered with light, as if he was swathed in flickering, ever-changing rainbows. His eyes gleamed with bright reflections of the trees around them, even though it was night, almost as if they somehow enhanced light. Then he saw this beautiful figure in the creature's eyes, a person blazing with light of a thousand different colors. He looked around him, trying to see this person. Then he moved his hand and saw that it was him. He looked down at his own arm and the glow wasn't there, only in the eyes of the gray. He knew about auras, that they were a faint electrical field emitted by the nervous system. The gray's eyes were somehow amplifying its visibility. As the tall gray came closer, the three short, squat ones buzzed nervously around him. "Okay," Connor said. "My name is Connor Callahan, and I'm going to do this. I hope." "Talk to us in your head. Form the words in your mind, but don't speak them aloud. We will be more easily able to hear you then." He sounded actually sort of okay. An ultra-precise voice that appeared right in the center of your head as if you were wearing earphones. He felt for that earbud, but it was gone. "How are you doing that?" "I can't hear you." "What? No, how do you do this?" "I don't know." "You're the only person we've ever managed it with. With the others, we have to use pictures. They can't hear us talking." He was quite close now, so close that Connor could see that he had faint white hair on his head and a wrinkled face. "I am old. We are all old." "Where are you from?" "Endless time. We are so old we've lost our history." "What is your mission?" "You are my mission." "What does that mean?" There was no response, except there was. He hung his head. "Are you crying?"
"I think so."
"Why?" He shook his head, then held out his hands. They were long and the fingers were like snakes tipped with claws. Slowly, his own hand shaking, Connor reached out to him. They stayed like that, their fingers an inch apart, both of them trembling. The three others came closer. They hovered around the taller one, bouncing slightly in the air when a gust of wind came. The tall one touched Connor's cheek with the softest finger he thought you could ever feel. It did not just touch you. It made vibrating electric contact with your skin. "Little Colt, not 10 minutes ago my touch would have made you run again. But you do not run."
"Am I going to get to go home?"
"Home."
"You're crying now."
The gray lay down in the snow. The three others hovered over him. Something then happened that was completely beyond comprehension to Connor. They had a black object that turned out to be a jar, which they opened, screwing the top off in a flash. Out of it, they drew three gleaming butcher knives. As Connor watched in stunned astonishment, they cut open the tall gray like Dad gutting a fish. The knives made a ripping sound. He struggled. They were killing him.
"Stop it!" Connor shouted. "Stop it!"
One of them turned toward him, brandishing his knife, and Connor backed away, holding out his hands, trying to convey that he would not interfere. They opened the gray from his featureless groin to the top of his head, splitting his whole body in half. Inside was a swirling mass of lights in a million, million colors, and Connor recognized them. They looked like an immense star field imaged by the Hubble Space Telescope. They looked like the whole universe, somehow contained inside the body of this gray. They lifted it out, and it wobbled in the air between them, the universe in the shape of a gray, snow swirling around it, flakes blowing into it and away into the vastness of the stars. There was humming, voices that sounded both innocent and wise, and the notes were so beautiful that Connor gasped aloud and wanted to cry because this was the richest, the most lovely sound he had ever heard. It was a sound with a scent, almost as if the flowers of heaven had bloomed. The little group of Greys with Connor were by no means the only ones who were witness to what was happening. On the contrary, there was vast witness in the huge device that carried the main body toward Earth. The gigantic sphere was now 2 light-years away, and had been decelerating almost since 1947, when it had turned in the direction of Earth. Large though it was, with its 1,000-mile diameter, it was still far too small to be detected by earthly telescopes. In fact, it probably wouldn't be noticed until it was actually in orbit around the planet, because its surface was black, designed to absorb any and all light energy that might reach it. Inside, a tiny sun glared in a strangely constricted sky. In fact, this was a miniature star just 600 feet across, built by the Greys and capable of shining steadily for 1 million years, at which time it would explode and instantly vaporize the whole sphere. If they hadn't made it long before then, it wouldn't matter anyway. There would be nothing left in the sphere but dust. Its inner surface was landscaped to an exact replica of the Greys' desert home, with cities made of white houses domed and looking like adobe. A shield moved around the central sun, bringing 50 hours of darkness every 50 hours to each part of the sphere, the same amount of day and night that the Greys had known at home. As they needed nothing and ate nothing, the Greys had no economic life. They had freed themselves from sexual reproduction an epoch ago, then discovered that pleasure is found in desire, and without reproductive needs, desire fades. They would have gone collectively mad in this trapped chamber had they not been able to venture with the earthly triads into the mind of man. They watched now, sitting in their houses, their heads bowed in concentration, as Adam gave his whole being, all of his experience, all of his knowledge, all that he was, to Connor. An outline of the child's body stretched across their strange sky, a body filled with stars, and with it came the wind, and the night, and the snow. Slowly, as they listened and felt, one of them, and then another, then more and more, raised his head and came to his feet. The tall, gracile ones, the short, squat ones, all of them, in their unimaginable billions, raised their heads. Then they ascended from their white cities, rose into the air and began to fly like so many soaring eagles, and it became clearer what was happening. These creatures who could neither laugh nor smile were doing the only thing they could to express an emotion they had not known in many a long age. They were dancing with happiness. The strange figure went round and round Connor, its head getting smaller, its legs and arms thicker, its body like a fluid of stars, taking on a different shape, the shape of a human being, and getting brighter, too. Each snowflake that touched the thing now went up in a tiny puff of steam, and it was beautiful, the smoking snow and the brightness and the humming of the thing as if the wind itself had learned to sing. Connor began to quake down inside his stomach and up his spine and everywhere, even in his toes and in his eyes, and he realized that the thing was vibrating too.
"Mama?"
The thing came closer to him.
"Mama?" Then the humming was all around him. It was in him, and his chest was vibrating with it, and he felt as if he had risen off the ground, or gotten very large. And for an instant the snowflakes that had looked like stars around the thing were around him, and were instead a whole tremendous universe of stars. Then it was dark again, and Connor had fallen down in the snow. He could not rise. He was completely weak. And when he closed his eyes he saw the universe in his head. And he saw it too when he looked at his palms, in his hands, stars swirling inside his skin. The three greys pushed at the tall one until his body closed up again. Then he rose in the air between them, and the four of them ascended, wobbling and buzzing, into the storm.
"Hey! Hey, you! I am still willing to negotiate!"
It got cold again. Connor could no longer see stars inside himself. The wind howled around him, and he screamed in agony and clutched his pajamas around him.
Whump, 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 whump.
Up in the snowy sky a shadow, black and huge, then light shining down, a glaring blue-white searchlight beam. The light shone so bright on Connor that he could hardly look into it. He knew that it was a helicopter and that it must be here to rescue him, and he got up and wallowed in the snow into a clearing among the pines, waving and waving and yelling with all his might, "I'm here! I'm here!" Wind from the rotors hit him, and with it came ferocious, lung-shattering cold. He screamed, covered his head, and turned away from the blast.
"Connor? Connor Callahan?"
a voice shouted, barely audible over the churning of the helicopter blades and the screaming of the wind. It was a man in a helmet, not a gray, coming down a rope ladder from the chopper. He had on a faceplate so you couldn't see his face, but he sounded strong and, above all, normal. The helicopter roared off into the storm and was gone. The guy knelt before Connor on one knee and quickly wrapped a space blanket around him. "I'm going to take you home, boy." Connor threw his arms around the man who held out his big gloved hands.
"Come on, buddy."
Connor was not a small kid, but the guy was really tall and picked him up easily.
"We need to warm those feet real quick."
Felt so good to be carried that Connor just leaned his head against the guy's shoulder and let himself be cozy in the space blanket. As the guy strode along, he watched the woods slip away behind them.
"Connor, lots of new things are going to happen to you. I suppose you've realized that."
"I'm sort of getting that feeling."
"You're going to have a teacher. You met her earlier tonight, Lauren Glass. I want you to know that you can count on her absolutely."
"Who are you?"
"Somebody else who's concerned with your well-being."
He could feel that it was true, that there was goodness radiating from this man like heat.
"Man, I'm glad you found me."
He closed his eyes.
"Sleep, child," the man said, and held his head against his shoulder.
Then somebody was shaking him. He stirred, pulled at the blanket, and shot straight up in bed.
"Dad!"
"You're having a nightmare, son."
"I was outside. I was outside, and..."
It felt so good to see Dad there that he just threw his arms around him.
"Listen, it was no dream. No dream. I was out in the woods with..."
"Connor, no."
"What?"
"Connor, out in the woods. Go on."
"I mean, in the dream, obviously."
"Look, let's go back to sleep." Connor lay back in the bed. Dad lingered.
"Good, let him stay."
"Why not tell him?" Connor asked.
"In time, Connor. In all good time."
The voice was different, Connor noticed, bigger, somehow echoing.
"Who are you?"
"The Collective."
"Okay. What is the Collective?"
"Connor, we are nearly 7 billion, and we need your help."
"You're kidding."
"Shh." "What? Kidding about what?"
"Let's go to sleep, Dad, okay?"
"Sure, Connor, of course."
He could hear singing then, the same tune that he had heard in the woods. He sensed, but in an indistinct, unformed way, an immense shadowy sea that seemed to be made up of numbers and words and this deep, fleeting song. It was knowledge, he decided, so high and fine that it was a music, totally simple, utterly pure.
"Something's happening to me, Dad."
Dad had tears in his eyes.
"Connor, You look like stars.
I do?
Dan could not understand. He saw his son, but his son now appeared to be a child made of the stuff of the night sky. A child whose body was somehow shining out of the planetarium of his own boyhood, and he heard a song from his boyhood. A beautiful voice humming, Siogan, the song by which his own mother had seen him off to sleep when he was scared, just come back from a journey into the dark. He sat on the bedside and met the music with the words in the old Welsh tongue of his mother's people. Hina blentin ar van manwes, cli dar hannes adieu han. Sleep, my child, at my breast. 'Tis love's arms around you. Slowly, as Connor fell into sleep, the stars in his body faded as if with the coming of morning, and Dan was left with his boy gently breathing, lost in the deep sleep that blesses and heals childhood. Caitlin came and he stood up. A miracle, he said. Caitlin, a miracle. He embraced her.
What do you mean?
He could not explain it, not as it had been. I just think you gave me such a grand kid. She leaned her head against his shoulder. Arm in arm, they returned to their own bed. Outside, the storm howled wild, and the footprints of the man in the mask, who had carried Connor home all unseen, and entered the house by stealth, and returned him to his bed, slowly filled with snow. 25. As the wee hours wore on, Mike drove the car yet again out of the snow and went to check the Keltons. He was very annoyed with this family who were so damnably late to bed, but this time there was only a single dim light showing out of the upstairs bathroom window. He trotted out into the broadness of the road. In the distance he saw a flash and thought perhaps he heard a shout carried away by the wind. A long minute's careful watching and listening brought only the hissing of snow and the moaning of the wind. He glanced up at the sky. According to the radio, the storm would not abate until morning. That was important to him, because his tracks had to be covered. He proceeded up the rougher edge of the property, where there would be flower beds in a few months. Any remaining suggestion of tracks would be harder to spot here. He moved to the back of the house, then examined the doors and windows. He found an unlocked window. Carefully, he examined it for any sign of an alarm system. Finding none, he slid it open and pulled himself into the house. He closed the window behind him. Standing absolutely still, he got used to the sounds of the place. He prepared some ether. His first challenge would be the dog. It was awake now, but would soon fall asleep again, as long as his odor didn't reach its nostrils. The reek of the ether would cover it, however. He closed his eyes and listened. He had to locate that animal, or he had to back out of here. He moved farther in through the dining room to the foot of the stairs in the front hall. It was sleeping on the landing. The instinct of the watchdog is to block the path. He took a step, another. Could he get around it? He took another step. Now he was on the step just below the landing, looking down at the animal. The step across it was too long, so he had to use the ether. He came down on his haunches, and laid the soaked cloth ever so gently over the animal's muzzle. He waited. The dog's breathing deepened. Now it began to rattle in its chest. He could kill the dog. He'd enjoy that. He detested dogs and their reeking shit, and their brainless fawning over people who weren't worth a damned glance. Like this family of fatzos. But the dog was too useful. First, the Greys couldn't control the minds of dogs. Second, he could. And to great effect. More confident now, he went to the top of the stairs. The parents would be the lightest sleepers, so he implanted and hypnotized them first. This hypnosis was a simple process, taking only a few moments. The secret of it was that the words were chanted in a rhythm that caused them to be perceived by the subject as his own thought. These people would wake up in the morning, thinking violently about Connor. When they came into range of his transmitter in town, the irritation to their temporal lobes would cause the anger to become an uncontrollable obsession. He went next into the boys' room and did them with equal efficiency. Just like that, and very neatly after the agonizingly slow start, his mission on Oak Road was accomplished. The three thieves all heard it at the same time, breath sliding through nostrils, getting louder. Then they saw Wilkes leave the Kelton's house. Very well, the collective said, let him go. There was a flicker of suspicion, however, when no soul drifted out of the structure. If Wilkes believed that the Kelton child was his target, why had he not killed him? Of course he would want to attempt to deceive the Greys. He would not want them to know he had done the murder. He would have created some sabotage within the structure that would make the death seem an accident. The collective had one of the three thieves physically observe Wilkes depart in his car. The two listened to the brown moaning of his mind as he drove away. And then the world was once again silent, and he rejoined his brothers in carrying Adam into Connor's sleeping form. Adam was not yet fully depleted. There remained in him structures of thought that would organize Connor's mind. These structures were the core of him, held in immensely complex fields of electrons that rested in permanent superposition. As such, they were both in Adam and were Adam, and were also everywhere in the universe, and potentially capable of tapping all knowledge. This core could not be implanted in Connor until the rest of Adam's being had settled in him, or the core would burn the boy's nervous system like an out-of-control nuclear reaction. The transfer of this last material would result in the permanent annihilation of Adam. In fact, this was the essence of Adam, the part of him that felt real and alive. Here and now is when Adam would feel actual death. He was scared. In fact, so were the thieves. This was the unspeakable thing that, as emotionless as they were, every Grey still feared, the final end, wherein even the memory of self disappears, and all the long years lived without emotion and thus without meaning slide away into useless nothingness. The whole collective watched, breathless in sorrow, each one hoping that Connor would find a way to save them, that after this death, there would be no other. The thieves crossed the yard and slipped into the house via the basement door and rose quickly through the darkness to Connor. They spread Adam's body, now thin and as pale as a wraith, and guided it over Connor. Adam had wondered how this would be, to die into another. He'd feared it, and out there in the woods, he'd cried. Do it. He felt himself dwindling into the boy, sifting downward as lightly but as inexorably as dew. All that had enabled him to relate to and understand man, what he had learned from Eamon Glass and Lauren Glass, slipped away into the sleeping child. He had given Connor all he knew, and his ancestors knew, of the universe. Now he gave him himself. As each tiny bit of his being detached and flowed into the hungry new nervous system that was spreading like a fire through the boy, he felt not regret, but an abiding joy, an emotion that he had not known he could feel. Thus, as he died, this ancient creature regained all that time and age had taken from him, the once rich spirit of the Greys with its love of truth and appreciation for the glory of the universe. It had been eons since a Grey had felt. Now, though Adam's experience hummed across the gulfs of space, and the whole collective felt with him the anguish and joy of his death. They sang in their chains, the Greys, as they felt, each of them, a taste of hope that they had not experienced since the day they left their planet and began this long, dark journey through the nowheres of the sky. Simply because they were there, water in the vast desert of his heart, the first tears Adam had ever shed, and his last, were tears of joy. Images flashed on the walls of Connor's mind, of the long and improbable histories of man and the Greys, dancers in a secret dance whose steps were measured in eons. He saw that we as a species had lived before, that we'd had another civilization and another science that had worked by different laws in a time when the light of the human mind had been brighter. He saw the tragic, lingering evening that we have named history, and heard along it the forlorn chanting of the Egyptians as they built boats that would never reach the sky, and the grim rising roar of human voices that signaled the onset of the modern world, and the ignorant hordes that now marched the earth, sucking every green blade and morsel. As this vision swept through him, he listened to the booming drums of time. And so it was done. Adam, ancient in his days, fulfilled a destiny that was also a tragedy. He died. The last light of the wraith flickered in the air above Connor's bed. Then it was dark. For better or for worse, this phase of the Greys' mission was complete. They searched for memories in Connor's mind that would shield him from the huge thoughts that now lay hidden within him. Time would be needed before he could bring them forth and put them to work. Looking through the house, they saw where he had put most of his effort, into his splendid trains. They planted his consciousness in one of his own superbly painted plastic figures. This would give him an unforgettably vivid dream. Connor found himself in his own toy railroad town, under his own streetlights, and everybody else was horrible and plastic, staring at him with painted stares. The sidewalk under his feet was plastic, the trees made of foam. A shrieking rose, and his own train screamed past, impossibly immense, electric fire roaring under its wheels. He was right in the middle of the street and he couldn't move. The plastic faces of the people around him stared expressionless. Then he saw a huge glaring giant looming back in the shadows of the sky, saw his own hand, now gigantic, come down. He heard a length of track screech as it came loose. He was trapped in his own train wreck, somehow part of one of the plastic people, as stiff and still as they were. He wanted to run. He was desperate to get off this street because he knew what would happen. But he could not run. He watched in fixed horror as the train's headlight flickered among the trees to the left, as it came roaring around the bend, and with a curious grace leaped off the track and sped toward him, its wheels churning, the headlight, a cyclops' eye. Then a warm hand was on his forehead. Mom was there. "Hey, mister," she said. "You're going to wake everybody on Oak Road if you don't stop running that train." I dreamed I was in the train set during the wreck. In the train set? I'd become one of my figures. I couldn't move and the train came right at me. She hugged him. "Oh, my love," she said. "Mom and Dad are always here for nightmares." He felt the depth of her love then with a power that he had never had before. He adored his mom. She was the most beautiful, the smartest, the nicest. She was like Dad, very much the best. Unseen now, the three thieves guided his mind back to a memory of a certain spring day long ago, when the lilacs were bobbing on the lawn and the leaves all were new, and he had come from glory, a tiny secret spark, and gone gliding down into the house and saw her sleeping, her belly big, and gone closer, and entered into her, and lay then in the cradle of her womb. "I love you too," he said. It felt so good to hug her. It felt like floating halfway to heaven. Dan also remained awake on this restless, uneasy night. He was determined to prevent the aliens from abducting his son. As he listened to Caitlin speaking softly to Connor, he felt an isolation that made him sad. She had been trying to forgive him, he knew, but there was a coolness in her now that even his most tender efforts, kissing her, speaking to her of love, could not seem to cure. He loved them, both of them, and yet he did not feel free to join them across the hall, where they were in such intimate communion. To avoid dealing with his couple crisis in the middle of the night, he turned his mind to what the Air Force people had said. Strange, strange stuff. Lies, of course, on some level. He would protect Connor from them until they told him the truth. There were dark corners in this world, and Connor was not going to fall into one, not as long as his dad had anything to say about it. Too bad Caitlin couldn't handle the idea of being an abductee. What of it? It happened to all kinds of people. Just read the books. The notion that people only remembered their encounters after being hypnotized by UFO researchers was, he had discovered, a lie, and a sinister one at that. And yet she had a point. No matter that he now believed it, because these two officials had confirmed it, how could anything like this be real? He closed his eyes, but sleep did not come. Sleep was far away. His mind returned to Caitlin. She had said that she was past it, that she understood. They had made love again. And it had been sweet, but not as sweet as ever. There was a thin sheen of emotional ice that just would not melt, and he thought now, at this vulnerable hour, that maybe it was the beginning of saying goodbye. Too bad he hadn't been able to keep these thoughts away. He opened his eyes again. She was singing in there now, in her high, haunting voice, a lullaby. It was better than the one he had sung, and he was sure that it was helping Connor more. Did she secretly want separation, perhaps even divorce? No, and yet, maybe yes. Maybe she hadn't articulated it to herself, not thus far. But she would. He feared that she would. She was the best person he had ever known. How had he ever busted this up? You were not going to find another Caitlin, mister. Not in this lifetime. And Connor. How could he live without Connor? Connor claimed a huge part of him, would of any father. He couldn't give that up. Fatherhood and husbandhood had become his meaning. He heard her stirring out of Connor's room. Rather than confront her now, he feigned sleep. He heard her come close, felt her sit on her side of the bed, and heard her sigh. Then she slid in beside him. She turned her back. He lay in silence for a time, then reached over and touched her shoulder. She didn't offer any sign that she was even aware of his touch. The night drifted on. In a little while, though, he was aware of movement in the room. When he opened his eyes, he was surprised to see Connor. Silently, his son came to the bedside. He looked down at them. Dan had seen him before as a child made of stars, but he was ordinary enough now. Connor? The boy smiled a little, said nothing. Caitlin stirred. What's going on? Connor reached over and took her hand, then took Dan's hand, and held their hands together. They remained like that, silent in the deep night, a family sailing the ocean of the unknown.
Part 8. Secret Soldiers. Or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God, who gave it. Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, verses 6 through 7.